Okay, it is just gone 3 o'clock. So here we go. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. So, because people are asking deeper questions than I expected, I decided to go back to this document, which is called The Word of the Buddha, which I've been working on for about 3 or 4 or 5 years in my spare moments, which aren't that much, so that's why it takes a long time. But here there's some really wonderful teachings of the Buddha in the suttas, but sometimes it's very difficult to actually to extract them and to put them in a form which are easy for people to understand. And sometimes you have to read it many times before the message starts to come out. And so in these translations I have here, there's something which is very powerful which emerges. First of all, the cause and effect part of Buddhism, of the Dhamma, that when something exists, it gives rise to something else. And that gives rise to something else. And one of the points here is you are not involved. It's not your even job to make it happen. It becomes an automatic process which answers some of those questions which people ask. If there's no self, who's doing this? Who is making it happen? And it's not anyone making it happen. It's a process. As we will begin to see in the first of these suttas, called no will, that will is chetana, needed. So here we go, and by putting it into 9 steps, it makes it much easier for modern people to understand. In the suttas, they don't have it 1, 2, 3, 4. They have it just paragraph after paragraph, and sometimes you have to try and separate which one comes next. It's even worse in the Pali, because when they write Pali, there's a whole string of words come together. And you have to just try and find out where those words are separated. And it's the same even when I learn how to read the suttas in Pali, in Thai. Thai characters, but Pali language. And there it was also really difficult to see how you can make mistakes, because whole sentences would just be flow into one another. And you had to make the understanding where the breaks are. And that's actually some of the difficulties in those old languages. After a while, you could see those breaks. And so now we use our modern way of conveying information with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. If you can go down a little bit further, you see with arrows, virtue leads to freedom from regret and all the way down to the bottom to liberation. But let's start from the top. No will is needed, the chetana. One who is virtuous does not need to generate will. Let me be free from regret. It is natural that one who is virtuous becomes free from regret. It's a very good place to start, because you know if you keep your virtue, you're a good person, then you have nothing to regret. Even if people accuse you of things you haven't done, it doesn't really bother you because you know, well, that, well, I didn't do that, it's not me, it wasn't my fault. Which means you don't regret and look back, oh, why did I do that? Stupid monk, I should have been more mindful. Why? But when you have virtue, you don't need to have regret. There's nothing to feel sorry for. And that's important at the end of your life. When you look back, when ordinary people, they look back upon their life, what they've done. And sometimes people do have regrets. They do have the unfinished business. Which means that there's some break somewhere in your virtue. Something, I took the easy way rather than the virtuous way. And when you do have such remorse, then of course you'll never have this wonderful freedom from regret. A lovely thing is about Buddhism, and a few people have already asked me this in the few interviews I've done so far. Some of you may have done something unvirtuous a long time ago. And you think, how long do I have to experience remorse? Or, you know, regret for something I did when I was even young, maybe as a kid. And now you're 60 or 70. And of course, in Buddhism, it's a wonderful teaching. You can let go whenever you feel it is appropriate. And it's up to you to forgive. Other people can encourage you to forgive. We can do a ceremony of forgiveness, but in the end, it's your choice. And the classic example which I give was of this young man who was born in Sydney, an Australian. And his, of course, he would be born in Australia if he was, would be an Australian if he was born in Sydney. That's a given. But anyway, as a young boy, he was playing with his best friend, the son of the next-door neighbours, on a pier in the many, many inlets of the harbour in Sydney. And like boys do, he pushed his best friend in off the water. Ha, ha, ha. Unfortunately, the best friend never came up. He drowned. He was killed. And this young man had to live next to the grieving parents. He'd killed his best friend. And of course, none of you would be able to blame a seven-year-old boy or something for that. There was no intention of killing his best friend. There was no even knowledge that such a thing could happen. But he had to see the family next door grieving, and was missing his best friend. And that guilt, apparently, this fellow just told me in detail about his journey. He was never good at school, even though he was very intelligent. He was never successful at anything he did, because there was something inside of him, the regret, thinking, I'm not good enough, and don't deserve to be successful or to be happy. And it's only later on in his life, he told me it was as simple and effective of just waking up one morning and thinking he does not need to feel guilty anymore. He could let it go. And from that point on, his life started to become successful. And it's one of those things in a journey that sometimes we think that we have to keep punishing ourselves. But the doors to the prisons of guilt are always open. You can walk out whenever you want and be free. But of course we feel, no, we haven't punished ourselves enough yet. That terrible guilt and punishment in our psyche, which we've grown up with. But, as a Buddhist, you can let it go. As long as you acknowledge what happened, You let it go, but it doesn't stop there. You resolve to learn from that experience. And that means eventually that you are a virtuous one, a good person. And because you are virtuous, you look back upon your week, your year, and you don't have to have regret. I know I shouldn't have done that act in the past, but I've learned from it and I've grown from it. I'm a different person now. Therefore, there is no regret anymore. In the journey of life, you realize its meaning. You made use of all of the parts of your life, so you have no regret. Imagine that was you on your deathbed. No regrets. It doesn't mean you've been a saint, but nevertheless, you've done really good things and you've learned from the mistakes of your life. So, one who is, when you're virtuous, you don't need to generate the will. It happens naturally. And when, number two, when one is free from regret, one does not need to generate will, let me be happy. It is natural. The one who is free from regret becomes happy. It's amazing how much guilt causes unhappiness in our world. Even if that sense of guilt and being at fault, even these days, I've noticed this from the culture which I came from in UK. I may be walking down the road and some person who is not paying any attention bumps into me. And I'm the one who said, I'm sorry. I've done nothing wrong. You know, you're the person who's bumped into me, but as a polite person, a gentleman, says, sorry. And I call that going into sorrytude. Not solitude, but sorrytude. And I don't, and it's not a sort of place which is worthwhile living in sorrytude. Solitude, yes, by yourself, I love my solitude. And the other place I like to stay in, very similar place, is called sillytude. Solitude and sillytude, but not sorrytude. So, when you don't have any regrets, it's amazing you're not carrying so many heavy burdens from the past. So many of the things we remember are the bad things which happen to us in life. And even though so many wonderful things happen to you in life, we don't tend to forget to remember those. We tend to remember the faults, the mistakes, the old two bad bricks in the wall. But imagine that you didn't have any regrets. In other words, you're not weighed down by the past. As I put it in one book, you're not weighed down by the many coffins of the past. Call them coffins because they're dead, they're finished with, they're over. Bury them for goodness sake. Don't carry them on top of your head. Which means that when you don't have to spend all of your time thinking about, oh, why did I do that for? I wish I could go back in time and start all over again. Why did that happen to me? Instead, you learn from it, let it go, and then you are free from the prison of the past. You go wherever you want. No more regret. That means you are happy. And it's not a happiness you have to develop. It's natural. If you get rid of the guilt and regret, of course you're happy. Have you ever been sick? Have you ever been so sick you had to go to the hospital? And you had to be in the hospital for days and days with these tubes and that tube and not being able to eat this and not being able to do that and just so difficult in the hospital. And then you're cured. You're in remission. You can go out and you're free. You don't have to worry about going to see the doctor and going to appointments and all that sort of stuff. So, because of that, what's the doctor joke? About the skeleton who went to see the doctor. And the doctor said to him, "So you're a skeleton?" "Yes, you don't know how long I have to wait in your waiting room these days for an appointment." I don't know if it's like that in Singapore, but it's certainly like that in Australia. So anyway, so that when you are free from all those sicknesses, you have the happiness of being free. People who have been released from jail, yay, now they can have a much more happiness. And so, when one is happy, one does not need to decide, okay, now I'll be joyful, have this thing called piti. It is natural that one who is happy becomes joyful. So happiness is almost like the underlying sort of general state of happiness. And every now and again that bubbles up to really nice happiness, being joyful. And for those of you who've already asked me, a couple of people have asked me already, that sometimes on a meditation retreat, or sometimes, you know, when they read a very beautiful teaching, or they see a Buddha statue, or sometimes they break up into tears, into pity. And that pity is a natural phenomenon. Great joy comes up into your mind, so much that you sort of cry sometimes in happiness. It's not sort of sadness because you feel upset. It's, you know, it's beautiful joy. And I encourage you to develop that. It's part of the path. It's an expression of this thing we call pity. And I was mentioning to somebody, there's a few places where that comes up to me every time. One of them is at the Vulture's Peak in Rajagaha. Even, I think I've been up there 3 or 4 times. Every time, that was where the Buddha meditated. The Buddha actually sat there. When I first went up there, there was a rock up there which looks like a vulture, which is why it was called the Vulture's Peak. And in my lifetime, it's broken off. I don't know if some tourist has broken it off or something, but I remember seeing it before it was broken. And you can understand why it was called the Vulture's Peak, because of that rock formation. But anyway, there are caves there, and there's no doubt in my mind, especially having seen that old rock, which was just a natural formation, that was where the Buddha spent so many years meditating. And it was a sort of place where, you know, you'd expect a Buddha to meditate. Simple, quiet, away from things, but close enough to the town that, you know, you could go on arms around there. So, that place, and the fact that, I'm not sure how it is now, but in those days it was just so peaceful and so clean. The last time I went there, I think because there was more tourists and more little things were thrown in the ground, there were lots and lots of dogs everywhere. And unfortunately those dogs would be doing their pooing in the caves. But anyway, that still got a lot of happiness and joy knowing that that was where the Buddha lived. And you could sit knowing that was where the Buddha sat. Ooh, that gives you goosebumps. But the other place which I really get inspired by was, and again, I don't know why, it's illogical, but outside of Sarvati, in the museum, it's just outside of Benares, Sarvati, outside of the deer park, outside of Benares, that there, in the museum, there is the statue, the original statue of the Dhammacakka Buddha with the wheel on the back. That was dug up by the Brits when they were there. It had been, most of those statues had been destroyed during the Muslim invasion, but that was underground somewhere, and they managed to it was almost perfect. It's got a little chip, I think, on the nose. Other than that, it's perfect. And there's something about that statue which gets me every time. So going into the museum in India and then going in there and just looking for it. And there was no directions. So I looked this way and that way and finally saw it at the end of a corridor. And as soon as I saw it, it was, I don't know why, the pity just flowed and just the tears came out. And I couldn't stop myself. Yeah, I felt a bit embarrassed, but I was there by myself because the other people were looking for somewhere else. So I was embarrassed, but I enjoyed a good cry. And the next time I went there, a few years afterwards, this time I was leading a group and I was taking them to that statue on purpose. I knew where it was and I said, it's a really beautiful statue. The last time it made me cry, but now, you know, I was mindful. I was just restrained. So I said, I know what's going to happen. I know what might happen. So I'm going to stop myself. Oh, so beautiful. The tears started coming down. Couldn't stop it. And the last time, the third time, that was when I was really looking forward to a good dose of pity, crying out of joy and beauty. But whenever you expect something, it always doesn't go the way you planned. So what I was waiting for, I had the tissue papers ready. And I turned the corner and there's a big cloth over it. The workmen were painting the ceiling and they couldn't see it because the paint would go on the statue. And instead of having some lovely, crying, joyful experience, which I've been looking forward to, that was my mistake. It was covered up all that way. And I couldn't see it. And then the workman took one look at me, never said anything. I couldn't speak sort of Hindi and he couldn't speak English. He took the cover off for us. They came down again. So that happens sometimes. Sometimes you hear some really good teachings of Dhamma and the tears come out. And it's even happened to me, and it's not sort of, as they say, pride or blowing your own trumpet, but sometimes I'm teaching and sometimes I let these words come out and I say, where the heck did that come? That's amazing. And sometimes I get tears from my own Dhamma talk. Weird as well, but it's not because it's mine, it's just because it's Dhamma. Oh, it's good. So that is to be expected, and that is good. It doesn't always come as beautiful tears, because sometimes your deeper meditation coming as like rushes of beautiful energy. But it certainly is extremely pleasant. So if you have tears when you're meditating, let them flow, especially tears of joy. If it's tears because you've heard that old joke so many times, oh no, fair enough, you know, that's not good. But mostly it's tears of joy. And the point is, you can't stop it. It is natural for one who is happy, who is joy, to experience joy. You can't stop it. But if you're generally miserable in life, of course, that won't happen. But if you know your level of happiness, the general level, average level of happiness is pretty good, pretty high, there'll come the time when it just bursts into this beautiful ecstasy type of joy. Now, so what happens? No, remember, it's not what you do next, it's what happens next. Please, I'm emphasizing this with this sutta. It's not what you do next, which people keep asking. I got the breath, now what do I do? I've got sort of the joyful breath, now what do I do? I've got the nimitta, now what do I do? Nothing. You don't do anything. It happens. When one is happy, you become joyful. When one is joyful, number four, you do not need to generate will. Let me be tranquil. Okay, I'm going to be tranquil now. Okay, body, tranquil. Mind, be tranquil. There are those, it's not mentioned in this sutta, but in other sutras, the tranquility, pasadi, there's two types of it, kaya pasadi and citta pasadi, the tranquility of the body. What does that mean? It means the body is just sitting here, doesn't need to move. It's comfortable, it's joyful, peaceful, it just sits. You know that once that somebody, they had one of those old movie cameras, and they decided to take a video of one of the monks I knew very well, and for an hour, and then speed it up. Put it on the fast forward. So when it's speeded up, any type of jerk or any type of movement gets exaggerated. You really notice it. And I was really amazed that when he was meditating, you sped up the camera and you couldn't notice it was speeding up. In other words, the normal speed or fast speed, he was still not moving. I thought that was really cool. It's one way you can really see if a person is sitting with deep tranquility in samadhi, they just don't move. And sometimes you can't notice that in normal time, but when you speed it up, you can notice it then. So anyway, that's what happens, the tranquility of the body, but also the tranquility of the mind. Peace. If you ever experience like peace and tranquility, it's you don't want anything, don't need anything. Just like the tranquility outside, there's no sounds. It's one of the reasons why we chose this place. It's not on a flight path. Sometimes you get private aircraft flying over, but it's not that often. The road at the top there is not that heavily used. And having lived in the rainforests, in the jungles, they are always noisy. You know, with the cicadas and so many other animals in there. This place is one of the quietest forests you can imagine, or you can actually experience. The animals, the kangaroos, they don't make much noise. You never see the kangaroos like cows, moo, moo. They hardly make a sound. The kangaroos make a little grunt sometimes if you go too close to them, but that's a grunt of submission. It's not of being upset. But that's all you hear. I know that sometimes those kangaroos, just the way they move, sometimes sound like human beings. And a little warning, because it's happened to retreatants, especially they've been in those cottages and in the rooms at the back. Sometimes a kangaroo has been at the back just chewing away at things. And as it moves towards the window of your room, you think, that's a person walking. And it's a night time because that's when they usually come out and eat. Late afternoon, maybe more early mornings. But they usually sleep during the day. And people have said, it was a ghost, I heard it. There was somebody, either a ghost or a stalker. Someone was actually walking right outside my window, really slowly. And they get afraid of some sort of predator. So it's only a kangaroo. No, it can't be. So I said, next night when you hear the stalker, just open the window and just have a look. And you see his little head come up. It's a kangaroo. So those are dangerous animals in this monastery, or this temple, or this retreat center. So when you have the tranquility, so when you have joyful, you have the inner tranquility and you can appreciate the external tranquility. It is natural that one who is joyful becomes tranquil. When one is tranquil, One does not need to generate the will. Let me feel the mental pleasure called sukha. It is natural when one is tranquil, one experiences the mental pleasure of sukha. That's why people say, what a peaceful place this is. And they sit out and they just enjoy the peace, the tranquility. That, by its very nature, is joyful, is happy, it's a pleasure of the tranquility of your surroundings, bodily and mental. When one experiences mental pleasure, one does not need to generate the will, let me enter jhana, samadhi. It is natural. The one who experiences mental pleasure experiences the jhana. Whoa, that's a bit of a leap. But that is how the Buddha describes this. When you have this beautiful mental happiness, then you don't want for anything in this world. When you don't want, that's the first of the five hindrances dealt with. You don't have any ill will or aversion. The second hindrance has been dealt with because you have this beautiful mental pleasure. And as I will say later on in this retreat, when you have that mental pleasure, you are energized. Your mind actually gets the energy back, which I said that when you first come here, you feel a bit tired, you need to rest a bit more. But after a few days, you know, you get reinvigorated. So sloth and torpor doesn't come at all. And nor does restlessness. Why are you restless when you have this beautiful pleasure in this moment? You don't need to seek for anything else. The mind is satisfied, energized. The third and fourth hindrances are dealt with. And no doubt this is an experience right in front of you of tranquility, peace, joy. You can't miss it. So the five hindrances have been restrained, which means the path into the jhanas are there for you. Number two is that this path, you see, it's not come from your will. You haven't decided to do this. It's as if you're a passenger on this journey. And it happens automatically. From simple things like virtue, you've gone through happiness and joy and tranquility and mental pleasure, and now it happens. Woohoo! And I keep on, I don't know, you must be sick of me by now, by keeping on telling you, you don't do jhanas. You get out of the way and let it happen. You stop interfering. You don't, if I don't do anything, the mind goes all over the place. It's because you do something, the mind goes all over the place. But I've got to stop it. Yeah, stop doing things. I was going to leave this story to later on, but it was the story of the aircraft of the future. In the aircraft, I read this on, I think it was an Air Asia magazine, because sometimes when monks go flying all over the place, I don't mean levitating, I mean like in commercial aircraft, so it would get very boring on the long flights. On this particular time, I got hold of a copy of the in-flight magazine. And I read it. And they had this interesting article. And on this article, it said that in the future, there'll only be two beings in the cockpit. Those two beings will be a dog and a human being. The human being will be the captain. But the captain's only job, the only thing he's trained to do, is to feed the dog. That's his purpose. And the job of the dog, highly trained dog, is to bite the pilot if he touches anything. And I thought, wow, what a beautiful simile for meditation. If only the Buddha could have done that and put a little dog inside your brains, or in your minds. And every time you did it, it's a natural process. So it did interfere with the process. That's the reason why people don't get the jhanas, because they keep interfering. The sense of self. So, the jhana happens. It's natural. The one who experiences mental pleasure enters the jhana. When one has experienced jhana, one does not need to generate the will. Let me see things as they really are. It is natural that one who has experienced jhana will see things as they truly are. Otherwise known as insight. Seeing what's really out there. Why is that the case? It is because the reason one doesn't see things as they truly are is because we always bend perception to suit what we want to see. With ill will, the second hindrance, we don't see what's really there. That's just too difficult to see. Okay, here is the experiment which was done in Imperial College, London, with my friend Bernard Carr told me about. Professor Bernard Carr, the student of Stephen Hawking. And it was called the Flower Pot Experiment. So these were all the top physicists and other scientists. And one of these fellows, the top scientists, said that he discovered levitation. And this was not a sort of a crackpot. This was a real top experimental physicist. So he invited all of his friends, you know, into the lecture theatre in Imperial College London, which is one of the top universities in London. And there he brought in a flower pot and put it on the laboratory bench. There was no wires at all. You could see just he carried it in himself. And he said there was the cameras were running, infrared, ultraviolet, the state of the art, if there's anything funny business going on, they would see it, and also that if it worked, they'd have a record of it. So what happened next was he needed them to assist him to create the right atmosphere for the spiritual miracle of levitation to happen. And so he couldn't get them to meditate, but at least he could get them to do some chanting, some simple chanting. And so he asked them all to chant the mystical holy word, Om. And he had all these old professors and lecturers, conservative, old, fuzzy haired, they always have, anyway, I don't know, those are the ones I remember, all chanting Om, Om, Om. The whole room was reverberating with Om. And at that point, the flower pot lifted above the bench. It actually levitated in laboratory conditions, recorded on cameras, still cameras, video cameras, they had all the evidence there. It worked. Wow. But of course, you've never heard about it, have you? There's good reason for that, because it wasn't actually an experiment in levitation. It was an experiment in perception. Because what had actually happened, underneath that bench, there was a very powerful electromagnet, very simple device, and that was the cause of the flower pot rising into the air. And as you also know, if ever you turn on a large current of electricity, It always makes the humming sound. I think in your case it would be 50 cycles per second, I think, because that was the frequency of the alternating current. So you'd always hear that humming. So what was the chanting for? So they wouldn't suss it out and find out it was electricity suddenly being turned on. It was to hide the current, that's all. Nothing mystical about it. So the interesting part was that many of those scientists, they said no, it did not rise up into the air. It stayed on the table all the time. And that was the whole point of the experiment. Even though it actually rose, because these physicists or scientists, they were, it couldn't happen. It can't happen. It's against everything they believed as a scientist. Therefore, it didn't happen. It was blocked off from their conscious awareness. They weren't even aware that it actually lifted. It stopped. What they thought should happen is the only thing they saw. That was the experiment in perception, which is one of the reasons why you can't see things as they truly are, when you can still have these hindrances, these biases, which bend the truth to fit you, to fit what you want to see, not what's truly there. That's scary sometimes, but that's the truth of it. Or the other anecdote, which I don't think you've heard, because I only remembered it a few weeks ago. One of my associates over in Thailand, he was about, I think, 6, 8, 9 months senior to me, but he was a veteran of the Vietnam War. He had actually volunteered to join the US Marines. And the reason why, he told me, that he was a street kid in Buffalo, New York, upper New York State, and he joined the US Marines to get even tougher. He told me, in the gang, he went around with motorbike chains, playing for keeps, and I believe that. He was a very tough guy, did a lot of bad karma. And when he was in Vietnam, he got shot in the back of the head in a firefight. And, you know, that was almost like death. So he got evacuated, and next thing he knew, on the chopper, next thing he knew, waking up, you know, in extreme pain, having his head operated on, and a lot of wounds as well. And then when he came to, the surgeon let him know that because of those injuries, he would be blind. He would not be able to see. They had to take out the wounded part of his brain. Much of that was where there was the organs, the stuff which deals with sight. So he told me, because he's a very good friend, and he said to me, it's interesting, like friendship, he was a really tough guy. He wouldn't make friends very easily, but he became a really close friend of mine simply for one nice thing I did to him. We were at this monastery in the northeast of Thailand, and everything was really boring. Monks are not supposed to do anything which is interesting. And we had the chanting. The chanting was really always monotone. We weren't allowed, no, not like we do now, you know, the sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. I'd be excommunicated for that in those days. But there was one chant we did before we did the blessing chants to invite the devas, invite the heavenly beings, when we do pirit chanting. And so it started off, it was the one chant which people did very sonorously in some monasteries. Pirita sameta sameta badanta. I mean, I'm really old now, so I'm not sort of a Pavarotti anymore. So I'm sort of got the size, but not the voice. So he decided to do it beautifully. And it was very beautiful what he did. And all the other monks, yeah, you're not supposed to chant like that. That's terrible chanting. And you could see he was so crestfallen. You know, he really tried to do something beautiful, inspiring. And all his fellow monks had just really put him down and criticized him. And I was only such a junior monk, and I came up to him and whispered to him, if I was a heavenly being, I would have come. It was beautiful chanting. And from that day on, I was his friend. Just a simple act like that, it's amazing just how they change. And he was a very good friend to have. He was so tough. To have him as a protector. It wasn't like that, it was just a really nice guy. But anyway, he told me many, many stories. But after, when he had the bandages taken off, he could actually see. The doctors were surprised, he was surprised, but he could see. But then what happened, he was playing baseball one day, you know, with his friends, because he got cashiered out of the army. And this was 72 or 3, I think, when he got cashiered out of the army. $1,000 a month from the army, the pension. That was a lot of money in those days. So he didn't need to work or anything, had a wonderful little life playing around. And then, playing around, enjoying himself. And then, playing baseball, and the batsman just hit the ball in his direction, and he ran to catch it, and then the ball vanished. It disappeared. It was there one moment, and then wasn't there. And then it reappeared again. He realized he had a blind spot in his vision. Because of the injuries, you know, suffered in Vietnam, there was an area, I think it said over here somewhere, which was blind. And what he hadn't noticed it because his brain had actually filled in the missing part for what it expected to be there. It extrapolated, filled in. And this is the first time he noticed it when a ball was flying through the air and it stopped and disappeared and reappeared on the other side. If you looked at the wall with all the bricks, the brain would actually fill in the bricks. And that's what a blind spot is. We fill in with what we expect to be there, know what's really there. That's called the delusion. So he said that was really weird, but it's great for his practice because he realized, wow, that's what how it works. So anyway, so from the jhanas, because there's no more expectations, there's no more bending perceptions, you see things as they truly are, because after the jhanas, no more five hindrances for a while. No more bending the truth. You see things as they really are because there's nothing more to bend anything. So if the flower pot rose up in the air, it just would. Imagine when you walked out after this talk, you found there was an alien outside and his spacecraft was just on the other side next to the stupa. What would you say? This can't be real. Because it doesn't fit in, you know, to your worldview. So that's why many aliens have probably visited this planet. Say, no, no, you're a joke, aren't you? What are you advertising? What are you trying to sell? Is this like the candid camera? or something. Because aliens don't exist, do they? Or do they? Well, you never see them when you don't want to see them. Maybe there aren't any. But anyway, we always, if they were, you wouldn't actually acknowledge their existence anyway. too difficult. So anyway, seeing things as they truly are is very difficult. And when one sees things as they truly are, one does not need to generate the will. Let me experience revulsion and fading away. This is libido. This is what somebody mentioned in the questions yesterday, what they said, dispassion and disenchantment. The words are actually much more powerful than that. It's not dispassion, it is fading away, viraga. And it's not just disenchantment, it is actually just a much more powerful revulsion. And the reason why I use that translation, even though you think, that can't fit in, that's far too negative, Ajahn Brahm. Just the way people thought, it's too much happiness in the early types of meditation. Joy and happiness, that can't be right. You're supposed to be equanimous. You're supposed to have no pleasure as a monk. Everything's supposed to be boring. And the same as the Nibbana, the Buddha said in one of these descriptions, just like, I don't think it's... I actually get the real thing because it's just a little bit further down in the notes. No, it's not the further down. Is it in this notes? Yeah, it is. The notes to the... Where's my Nibbida note? It's coming down here. It's coming soon. Nibbida. Some are surprised to read such a negative rendering of revulsion for Nibbida. However, in the Anguttara Nines, Sutta 15, called the boil, it compares the human body to a boil that is many years old with foul, disgusting ooze coming from each of the nine orifices. That's why you find it in the nines. Sometimes people say, oh, you monks, you really get into this foul, disgusting ooze coming. So whenever you say ooze, please give it sort of some guts to it. Ooze. It would be expected to regard the boil with Nibbida. So that was one of the reasons why he said disenchantment doesn't fit. Would you be merely disenchanted with an inflammation dripping foul-smelling pus or feel revulsion? Which one would you feel? Yeah, revulsion. So this is something which is quite powerful, really. It's as if, like, you've, what have I been doing all these years? Attaching to these things, thinking they're pleasurable, seeing I'm going to get something out of this, and think, this is revolting what I've been up to. So anyway, when one sees things as they really are, it is as if you suddenly wake up to the fact you're in a very unpleasant prison. One experiences negativity to your situation, not mere disenchantment, you feel revulsion, enough to get out. Okay, so now we're going a bit, that's from the suttas there. Where are we going here? Okay. Because I just went a bit further ahead. Okay, now a bit more. I'm not talking to myself, by the way, because there is no self. So I get out of that. I'm talking to my no self is talking to my no self. You've got to be careful these days because the world doesn't recognize some of the stuff the monks get up to. First time I came over here to Australia, there was this one guy who had an epileptic fit. I'd only been in Australia a few weeks at our temple. So I called the ambulance, and then the ambulance came pretty quickly. This is a true story. It's not one of those like jokes which I say is a true story, but they first thing they did to ask him, what's your name and what day of the week is it? And he didn't know the day of the week. And I asked the ambulance drivers afterwards, is that's one of the tests they do, and if they don't know the day of the week, you're straight in the ambulance, you've had some sort of episode. And afterwards, I breathed a sigh of relief, I'm glad they didn't ask me. I live in the present moment. I don't know the day of the week sometimes. So from that time on, I tried my best to remember the day of the week. So I can think, okay. So Nibbana Viraga. And when one experiences revulsion and disappearing, viraga disappearing, fading away, It is natural. One does not need to generate will. Let me realize liberation. It is natural. The one who experiences revulsion and fading away. Sorry, the one who experiences revulsion and fading away realizes liberation. You're free. So all that path is not what you do. It's not what you don't do. It's not you try and stop things or hurry things along. Like planting a tree, it grows at its own rate. When it wants to put flowers out, it puts flowers out. When it makes its fruit, it makes its fruit. When the fruit drop, they drop. Natural process. And to make it easy to understand, you have this little progression. You don't know, I'm not really computer literate. It took me so many hours to find out where these arrows are on my sort of computer thing. And then you actually find how I can put them in the right place. Sorry? Oh, no, no, don't say anymore. I was so proud of the fact that I actually got something which made a bit of sense. Virtue to freedom from regret. Anyway, that's the only icons I could find. If somebody wants to find some better icons, but yeah, I think you get it. No, virtue.
I mean, the
eye at the time. Yeah, they're even harder to find. Anyway, virtue leads to freedom from regret, leads to happiness, leads to joy, to tranquility, leads to the mental pleasure of sukha, leads to jhana, leads to seeing things as they truly are, revulsion fading away to liberation. Easy peasy. So it just happens. Very good. That was Mara going out. He realized he's been totally confuted and can't do it. So that is the sutta for today. This is one of the first of the things which happen one after the other. So the next one we have for tomorrow is, they call it irreverent, when some of the other qualities which stop you flowing along this gradual path of the virtue, the peace, and the wisdom. But that is coming tomorrow. Was that more interesting than yesterday's one?
Yes.
Slower?
Yes.
Very good. And hopefully that with a little bit of commentary from, because I know there's still some people this is a bit much, jhanas, what's that all about, with some stories to make it appropriate for everybody. Okay, so that's timed it well to almost 4 o'clock. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.